And unfortunately, around the world, most people, in some degree or another, trust the system. And so perhaps that's keeping things afloat longer than it should be. However, we are starting to see definite cracks. I mean, government debt and deficits around the world are absolutely insane. I mean, looking at a country like Japan, we're at over 250% debt to GDP at this point in time. I don't know how that system's going to survive for much longer. I believe perhaps Japan could be the first domino to fall, or the canary in the coal mine, whatever expression you want to use at some point. And we're seeing Japanese government bond yields rising to historically high levels. So that's certainly concerning. But we're also seeing just record government spending occurring in the United States as well. I mean, this war currently being waged is estimated to be costing approximately $900 million per day, which is rather significant. And, you know, they're also asking Congress for an extra, what is it, $2 billion plus, some huge number that they're asking for. I think it's might be $20 billion. To keep the war going. And so that's certainly putting pressure on things. But the sad thing is that's a drop in the bucket when we look at the overall debt. They're not looking at gold as an alternative to the current system because they can't print gold. And the whole way that they have amassed and wield their power is through the fiat currency system. And so they're going to milk it for everything it's worth until the very bitter end, and they're already formulating plans for what to do when it eventually ends. Perhaps they already have the plans 100% in place at this point. And so it could collapse very soon. We don't know. Could the war in Iran continue to escalate and be used ultimately as cover for a controlled demolition of a system which they see as already dying, and then to bring in the alternative that they already have prepared for everyone? I mean, the list just goes on in terms of the tailwinds behind the gold sector. But the point is to take your wealth into your own possession so nobody can control it. You know, we saw in Canada, they froze everybody's bank accounts and no bank CEO asked any questions. It wasn't like, whoa, 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 hold on. You want us to freeze people's bank accounts? Let's take a step back and maybe discuss it. They were like, yes, sir. Press the button, immediately frozen. So you don't think that's going to happen, that can't happen again? As we're seeing in Canada, these hate speech bills get potentially passed and these internet censorship bills. I mean, what's the next step? You get your account frozen if you don't follow whatever political party is in power. And trust me, it cuts both ways. People complain about the liberals and whatever running Canada. I'm Canadian, that's why I've got a bit of a rant on this. But whoever's in power, doesn't matter, NDP, Conservatives, or whoever, if they have, if they know they have that weapon that they're now allowed to use free and clear, you know, it's kind of a joke because the Court of Appeals ruled the Emergency Act that caused, was part of the whole bank accounts getting frozen to be illegal, and then proceeded to dole out zero punishments for that.
Good day, everybody. It's Steve Yang here with Natural Resource Stocks, where we mine for stories that matter. And today I'm joined by a respected voice in the space, Jesse Day. Jesse is the host of Commodity Culture. He has interviewed some of the top minds in mining, macro, and hard assets. And today we're flipping the lens a bit and gathering his perspective on where things stand, on what he's learned, and his thoughts on how to be best positioned for what's ahead. Jesse, glad to have you. Thank you for being here.
It is an honor to be here, Steve. Thank you so much for the invite and very excited to dive into all these topics today.
Awesome. Well, Jesse, I wanted to pick your brain. Just wanted to zoom out a bit and see how you think, how healthy the global monetary system looks right now. And, you know, are we starting to see real cracks or is it just more noise? How do you see things?
Yeah, this is actually a very difficult topic to address in an accurate manner simply because of all the hyperbole that's getting thrown around online. Because depending on who you talk to, some people say it's the last legs of the global fiat currency system. Of course, this is the first time since, you know, in recorded human history that the entire planet has been under a fiat currency regime since Nixon took gold backing away from the dollar in 1971. Now, many would argue problems started much further earlier ahead than that. Of course, we were under the Bretton Woods system prior to Nixon removing gold backing from the dollar, which meant the US dollar was pegged to gold, but most world currencies, the major ones, were pegged to the dollar. So they were pegged to gold by proxy. Obviously not an ideal system, one the US took full advantage of, and then eventually decided, hey, you know what, we want to print a bunch of money to fund the war in Vietnam and a bunch of other stuff. So let's just forget about this whole, you know, gold backing system. So this is actually pretty extraordinary that it's lasted this long, from one perspective. From another perspective, I mean, it's simply faith in government that is issuing these paper currencies that keeps them alive. And unfortunately, around the world, most people, in some degree or another, trust the system. And so perhaps that's keeping things afloat longer than it should be. However, we are starting to see definite cracks. I mean, government debt and deficits around the world are absolutely insane. I mean, looking at a country like Japan, we're at over 250% debt to GDP at this point in time. I don't know how that system's going to survive for much longer. I believe perhaps Japan could be the first domino to fall, or the canary in the coal mine, whatever expression you want to use at some point. And we're seeing Japanese government bond yields rising to historically high levels. So that's certainly concerning. But we're also seeing just record government spending occurring in the United States as well. I mean, this war currently being waged is estimated to be costing approximately $900 million per day, which is rather significant. And, you know, they're also asking Congress for an extra, what is it, $2 billion plus, some huge number that they're asking for. I think it's might be $20 billion. To keep the war going. And so that's certainly putting pressure on things. But the sad thing is that's a drop in the bucket when we look at the overall debt. And so this is a system that serves the elites, that serves the political elites, and no one else. It enriches them. It allows them to consolidate their power and wealth and serve themselves in their own circle of insiders. And perhaps no other era is emblematic of that than the one we're in today, where now government corruption, bribery, extortion, all insider trading, all of these things have now become blatant and in your face. Whereas it used to go on, but they would try to hide it or dance around it. And now it's just like, you know what? I'm the president. I'm launching a crypto coin. Then my wife's going to launch a crypto coin and we're going to rug pull everybody. What are you going to do about it? You know, like what is more emblematic of the system that we live under today than actions such as that? It's completely insane. And I think perhaps if we were to look at it from the perspective of the political class now trying to brazenly loot as much as they possibly can before the system collapses, I also think that an increase in government surveillance and censorship around the world, but particularly in the West, not that a lot of these people like to say, well, at least, you know, using whatever example, Canada, UK, Germany, well, it's not North Korea, it's not China. I mean, that doesn't make it okay. People like to use these comparisons. That doesn't mean, well, that's fine. At least it's not as bad as China. Let's just let it happen. I think part of this potential criminalization of speech, criminalization of, you know, messages that are viewed as anti-government or viewed against certain agendas could also be the powers that be locking down this control grid in the expectation of a potential collapse of the monetary order and the monetary system. Because at that point, you want to get as much control over the citizens as possible before that happens, so that then should that event occur, you've already got tabs on everyone, and they're also much more likely to buy into whatever alternative or whatever solution that you then offer them, which could, of course, be central bank digital currencies. Although I'm not sure how far along that technology is developed at this point. We could be in an era where, you know, governments have not admitted how far that technology has gone, and perhaps it's ready to launch. That's one possibility that, you know, the EU is talking about the digital euro being launched, I think, later this year. We'll see how that plays out. It could be universal basic income. It could be a number of different initiatives from, okay, to get together. We're all going to get through this together. Of course, they're not going to say it's due to money printing. It's due to mismanagement of government funds. It's due to blatant and brazen corruption that the whole system's falling apart. They're going to blame it on the war in Iran. They're going to blame it on Russia. They're going to deflect the blame to some area where they can try to get the citizenry to kind of all agree. And then use that to implement potential restrictions on freedom. So that's kind of how I see the whole system set up right now. This can could get kicked down the road much, much longer than many people anticipate. That's the other thing. People have been talking about the collapse of the monetary system for decades. So it might not be in our lifetimes, but I mean it's we're seeing the cracks, definitely.
So a monetary reset, you think that this, how do you think is very likely or possibly we are going to see this kick down further? They can't kick down maybe another decade or two. Is that kind of the likely possibility here?
Yes, I think that's a very likely possibility because we have to keep in mind that the powers that be, the power brokers, the banker class, the elite political class, the small circle of families that kind of control them are not into sound money. They're not looking at gold as an alternative to the current system because they can't print gold. And the whole way that they have amassed and wield their power is through the fiat currency system. And so they're going to milk it for everything it's worth until the very bitter end. And they're already formulating plans for what to do when it eventually ends. Perhaps they already have the plans 100% in place at this point. And so it could collapse very soon. We don't know. Could the war in Iran continue to escalate and be used ultimately as cover for a controlled demolition of a system which they see as already dying? And then to bring in the alternative that they already have prepared for everyone. That could be one possibility. We could also see a bifurcation, as we're already seeing geopolitically, of the various powers, whether in the Western world we start to see, the CBDC system, more restrictions, more rules. Perhaps at the same time, the East and many of the countries such as Russia, China, et cetera, which have been more traditionally authoritarian, one could say. Start to perhaps soften their approach in response and return to sound money to some extent. I mean, Russia has already talked, certain members of the Russian government and central bank have already talked about gold standards. We've heard about the BRICS payment system supposedly going to eventually be backed by gold. So this is very interesting. China's rolling out this CHIPS payment system, which could potentially at some point involve gold. It's a yuan-based system. But we could see this bifurcation of East and West when it comes to monetary systems. There doesn't need to be one system for the world. So that would be an interesting development to watch. But I think we're starting to see signs. It's just impossible to time. But I would anticipate this isn't happening tomorrow. This could be a decade plus shift in the system.
So Bretton Woods came out of World War II. I mean, I guess it came to a place where it's like, hey, we need something different. We need something new. This isn't working. So what would it take? I mean, I'm guessing we would need some sort of realization, like, whoa, like this is worse than we thought. This isn't working. Like, what would we need in terms of a monumental shift? I'm guessing we need some sort of seismic realization somehow. I mean, and the transition, I assume, is not going to be smooth and it's going to be pretty disruptive. Like, what kind of ripples are we anticipating and how can we best prepare?
Well, many people would say that the current war going on in Iran is the US struggling to maintain its hegemony, similar to what they did with Venezuela, that kidnapping of Maduro, and extraction and arrest, and this
Well, I'm
subsequent
sorry, Jesse.
war.
Jesse, I think
Yeah.
that was for democracy. I think you're getting confused there.
Yes. It's to spread democracy. Yes. I mean, it's amazing. Post World War II, we've had what 100 plus regime change operations to spread democracy. And some people are still buying this stuff. It's pretty amazing. Look, here's the real truth of the matter. Most of my viewers are American. I love the American people. The American government as an entity has been one of the most, actually, I'll say this, the most barbaric and evil operator on the international stage post World War II out of anyone. It's not even close. They are the terrorists they claim to be fighting against. Just straight up. I'm sorry. Like I said, I love the American people. I love the spirit of freedom that a lot of them have. I mean, when all of the restrictions around the pandemic came to Canada, everybody was 100% on board, and you were bullied into compliance. Looking to
No.
the states, it was more of a 50-50 split, which is much more of an encouraging sign in terms of people who want to exercise their fundamental rights. And I believe that the Constitution, which the country was founded on, has a lot of very positive things in it. I think it's been thrown out the window, much as the Charter of Rights and Freedoms has been thrown out the window in Canada. We're dealing with a system that hates its citizens and wants to extract as much wealth from them as possible. So if this war is in fact an existential fight for the United States to maintain global dominance, if they are eventually defeated, forced to withdraw, I don't know what that's going to look like, because I don't think Iran is just simply going to allow them to withdraw and say, okay, it's over, guys. We accomplished our missions. I think they're going to continue to attack GCC member military bases, energy infrastructure, et cetera, until the entire region will agree to completely divest itself of America and perhaps form a new alliance, something like that, which of course America will fight to the absolute bitter end to stop, because it's run by these neoconservatives who believe that America needs to have an enemy to survive. And that is ultimately the ideology that is driving them. So that is a very tenuous and precarious situation that means that as the system shifts, as we see the global monetary order shift underneath all of this, it's also going to be extremely chaotic. It's going to, like I said, perhaps take much longer to play out than people think it will. And it's going to require us to be protected through sound money, which is why I believe that gold, especially gold, but also silver, physical gold and silver, is ultimately one of the best instruments one can use to protect yourself. I also hold Bitcoin. I know that's, sacrilege in the gold and silver bug community. I'm not a big proponent of Bitcoin. I think it's a very speculative asset. It's been around for a very short time. But what Bitcoin does allow one to do is remove your assets from counterparty risk, much in the same way that gold and silver does. It has certain advantages in that you can transport it across borders, millions of dollars if you want, instantaneously. So it's easier to carry in the case that you, just to give an example, I left Canada during the pandemic. The rules and restrictions were too much for me. I was like, I'm out. I'm going to the Balkans, former Yugoslavia, where these people do not follow rules and regulations. And I had to sell some of my silver because it was simply too much for me to carry out of the country. It didn't make sense. So, I converted some of that into Bitcoin. So for me, that was a real world example of being able to remove my wealth from counterparty risk and take it into my own possession, of course, in cold storage, not on an exchange, and then move somewhere else and still have access to that capital without anybody being able to know about it. Whereas if you have too much gold or silver in your luggage, that could be an issue. That's just one example, but my point is, get your money out of the system to some extent. And I'm not one of those extremists who will say, get your money out of the bank. Banks are going to collapse tomorrow. We could certainly see a banking crisis, but you have to have some money in the system to be able to survive, to take advantage of certain opportunities that present themselves. But everybody should at least have some portion of their wealth in outside of counterparty risk. And I would, even though I, like I said, I hold Bitcoin, I would recommend that first and foremost, one look to physical gold and silver, and then perhaps speculate on something like Bitcoin in the future. But gold and silver are just a foundation, and it's something that's been, said so many times in so many different ways. But it's interesting because it hasn't caught on with the general public. We live in an echo chamber, me and you, Steve, where we host shows where we talk about gold and silver all the time, and it's just accepted as fact that, of course, you want gold and silver to be the foundation of your portfolio, physical gold and silver. When I have friends who know I'm doing some show about investing and they contact me and they say, hey man, what should I invest in? I'm like, do you own any gold or silver? And they're like, what are you talking about? Yeah, you don't even buy any stocks or anything. You need to get that insurance policy before you start speculating in markets. And most of the time they never contact me again. And is it because people just don't get it? They don't, because their thinking is, oh, so you think gold's going up? That's the usual reaction when, and I don't know what gold's going to do. I think over the long term, it's going to be up and to the right as we see continued monetary debasement, out of control corruption, geopolitical uncertainty. I mean, the list just goes on in terms of the tailwinds behind the gold sector. But the point is to take your wealth into your own possession so nobody can control it. We saw in Canada, they froze everybody's bank accounts and no bank CEO asked any questions. It wasn't like, whoa, 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 hold on. You want us to freeze people's bank accounts? Let's take a step back and maybe discuss it. They were like, yes, sir, press the button, immediately frozen. So you don't think that's going to happen? That can't happen again? As we're seeing in Canada, these hate speech bills get potentially passed and these internet censorship bills. I mean, what's the next step? You get your account frozen if you don't follow whatever political party is in power. And trust me, it cuts both ways. People complain about the liberals and whatever running Canada. I'm Canadian, that's why I've got a bit of a rant on this. But whoever's in power, it doesn't matter, NDP, conservatives or whoever, if they know they have that weapon that they're now allowed to use free and clear, it's kind of a joke because the Court of Appeals ruled the Emergency Act that caused was part of the whole bank accounts getting frozen to be illegal and then proceeded to dole out zero punishments for that. Now, in South Korea, their president was sentenced essentially to jail for life for calling martial law for a day where nothing happened, nobody got hurt, and they're like, you're going away, buddy. And in Canada, they're like, it's illegal. Justin Trudeau's on a yacht with Katy Perry somewhere. You know what I mean? Like, what is going on here? My point is that the system continues to be brazenly corrupt, as I mentioned earlier, and so you need a way to extract your wealth from that system and take it into your own possession, whether that's gold, silver, or real estate, some hard assets. So that would be, I think, the best way to protect yourself.
Jesse, you mentioned the war, the conflict in Iran. For by the way, it's telling how a war to this magnitude can get started without Congress support, and that tells you kind of the amount of we're talking the elite and held the whole system. But the war in Iran, it's almost like some people would say that it feels like a catch up to China and their lock on the natural resources or falling behind. Venezuela, you got Greenland. I mean, is how much of this is catch up and how much of this is a indirect threat to China? Along with that, do you mentioned bifurcation, East versus West sort of thing in terms of monetary system. Do you see a dual global monetary system here, global, like a dollar versus, I don't know, the BRICS currency, for instance. What are your thoughts on where that might be headed?
In terms of the war with Iran, how much of it is related to China? I think a lot of it could be. I recommend people check out one geopolitical analyst named Brian Berlichich. He has a very interesting theory that this is at its core about China and about cutting China off from energy, from cheap energy sources, from buying oil for renminbi. And he also believes that Israel is actually a vassal state to the U.S. and that all of the information being spread by various influencers on Israel being in charge is actually propaganda being propagated by the US government. He refers to policy papers from the early to mid 2000s that actually spell out step by step how they're going to use Israel as a scapegoat in a war with Iran. So that's worth something. That's worth checking out. I'll
Interesting.
just say that. Yeah, it's very interesting because everybody at this point in time believes Israel's driving the show. At least people who are against this war, the big influencers like Candace Owens, Tucker Carlson, etc., Joe Kent, the guy who resigned, and so people are saying they're controlling Trump and Trump fell into their trap when Brian's saying it's the opposite actually. Trump is the one calling the shots, and the U.S. government's the one calling the shots. So that's one thing to keep in mind, but it. There's also the side of this being a religious war because there's actually religious fanatics on both the American and the Israeli side. Pete Hegseth is a Christian Zionist who believes in the prophecies from the Old Testament of Armageddon needs to come for the Savior to appear, and the Third Temple needs to be rebuilt. So you've got some nut jobs. Trump has like a spiritual advisor person, some crazy Christian Zionist lady who believes Trump is God's messenger on earth. And I'm sure, I don't know how many people out there have seen these pictures of these weirdos all touching Trump and praying and stuff like that. It's insane. And then, of course, you have the extremists in Israel who believe that Armageddon, that in the end of days, the battle of Gog and Magog, that in the end of days, the world will turn against Israel, and this will bring about the coming of the Messiah. I might not be getting all the details right, so biblical scholars don't come at me, but the point is, this end result of some big Armageddon-like event occurring is favorable light by certain people in the administration of the US, in Israel. And of course, we're dealing with the Shia Muslims, so we're dealing with a certain sect of Islam as well when it comes to the Iranian side. So some could argue this is a holy war, a modern day holy war, which is also kind of terrifying because the motivations of the people behind it then become completely illogical. Because if they're all working off the basis of some sort of end of days scenario from their respective religions, or biblical or Quran based, whatever the messaging they're using to put behind this, it gets a little scary. So I think there is a religious aspect. I think that ultimately, from America's point of view, they do want to cut off China. So I think it's kind of a multi-layered narrative that's actually, the reality is multi-layered, whereas the narrative we get fed is something more simplistic. Of course, now another story is that the big shale oil fields in the United States, the Permian Basin, the Bakken, the Eagle Ford, they are starting to roll over, according to many extraordinarily well-versed analysts. I recommend people check out the work of Gehring and Rosenzweig. They've done some very detailed research on these big shale fields in the US. They believe that they are depleting rapidly, and the cost to economically produce oil in those regions is rising. And as time passes, production will drop off dramatically, much more so than people expect, because people are used to the US being an energy superpower. It's a net exporter. It's one of the biggest, world's biggest exporters. But that could be a part of the story as well. And also a part of the story with Venezuela in getting access potentially to those oil reserves and being able to take over the Strait of Hormuz in the Trump administration's mind, and also get access to the oil reserves in Iran. And kind of get more control over the global energy system so that they are able to continue to produce cheap energy. Because that's what Trump has stated very clearly from the beginning of his presidency, that he wants to bring energy prices down. He's done the opposite at this point in time. They're going ballistic. But at the end of the day, if you don't have energy, your ability to survive and thrive as a civilization is put into question. And so a large part of America's global hegemony is being related to the shale oil revolution and their ability to produce large amounts of energy. And so I think that could be another piece of the puzzle as well. In terms of the global monetary system bifurcating, I think that's a very real possibility. The future of the petrodollar is being put into question, which again is another layer to this, because the petrodollar in which Gulf state countries agree to sell their oil only in exchange for US dollars is one of the things that has propped up the dollar as the world's reserve currency. So now that we're seeing more trades, I don't think it's any accident or that it's just because, oh, Iran's allied with China, so we want to do oil for renminbi. I think they're doing that to kind of show we're chipping away at the petrodollar here. And that is something that could perhaps also be an existential threat in the minds of the neocons who run American foreign policy.
So the conflict in Iran, the Strait of Hormuz, you're seeing maybe some thought, legitimate threat, possibly that things may be moving to the petro yuan. How much of that is a concern for to the U.S. government?
It's a very big concern to them. I think perhaps more of a concern than they're letting on. Ultimately, the renminbi is another fiat currency that the Chinese government can create units of. So I don't think long term it's going to survive if they continue to operate with it simply as a paper currency or digits in a computer. I think eventually we're going to have to see gold enter the system in some form or another. And that might be why China is one of the largest producers of gold, as well as, it's widely believed that they are massively understating their own gold reserves. And so if they have way, way more than they say they have, and By the other hand, it's believed by many that the United States is massively overstating. They won't audit Fort Knox. I mean, that's completely insane. Why wouldn't you do that? So essentially, if that gold's not there, then the US is in much more trouble than China. If we do see a shift in the monetary system, I think the concern is if China and its partners start to eventually shift to a gold-based system. And now China is an authoritarian government, so they're not going to allow their citizens to run free with sound money and do whatever they want. If they do involve gold in the system, it's likely going to be in international trade. So, for example, BRICS member nations trading between each other using some sort of gold-backed currency backed by actual, you know, allocated gold in these vaults, of which China has set up a few, fully trackable, so full transparency. Because people say, oh, these countries can't trust each other. Yeah, they can't, but if they all agree and they all stick to this agreement, then I think ultimately their system can work. It's a massive hurdle. It takes years for this to happen. It's not something that they flip a switch and it happens overnight. But I think if those countries do start to involve gold in some form or another when it comes to international trade and perhaps make it a standard between them, then that puts a major threat on the petrodollar system. It puts a major threat towards the US as a reserve currency. But we have to keep in mind the amount of euro dollars that exist, which is essentially US dollars that exist outside of the US and are being transacted between other countries. So many countries in the world actually issue debt based in US dollars. They trade with each other using US dollars, and it's a tremendous amount of money. So this is what kind of another part of the puzzle that people don't look at very often, and why it's going to take much, much longer than people think for the US dollar to just, you know, die or disappear. That's not going to happen. I do think the dual system, some sort of dual system is more likely, competing monetary systems. So that's something to watch out for. But ultimately, I think it's going to be very chaotic. I think it's going to be very unstable geopolitically for the next while. Some would say we're in the fourth turning. I think people got to buckle up and hold on to their precious metals.
Jesse, you know, you talk to a lot of people and, you know, you see different perspectives from all over. I'm sure they don't all agree. So if you can tell us a little bit about how kind of that shapes your thinking and like, how do you decide, you know, what really matters? And is there anyone in particular maybe who's challenged your thinking a bit and maybe even made you rethink kind of your perspective on things?
Yeah, I think actually every time I sit down with somebody, my perspective gets changed a little bit, because one of the things that I find interesting and strange to me is that, you know, I disagree with a lot of things my guests say, but I know that they're ultimately pretty experienced people in financial markets, often in geopolitics and with many different subjects, and they have their own point of view. And so even if I disagree with somebody on one aspect, I want to see if there's any points where we agree on. I want to see if there's anything perhaps I initially disagree on, but perhaps there could be some bridge that could be gapped there in terms of maybe part of what they're saying is true, in my view. But I always see comments that when if somebody says something bad about Trump, somebody will say, I like this guy until he talked about Trump. Now I shut the interview off, or vice versa. Somebody's for another politician or political class or political party. Okay, well, this guy's an idiot. Everything he said is now invalid. Well, that doesn't make any sense. Like somebody who's an expert on the gold and silver space who says something in particular about a political party, it doesn't mean that everything they said about gold and silver is now invalid. So I try to keep a very open mind that way. In terms of somebody who's challenged my belief the most at this point in time is probably Tom Luongo, who I actually really like and enjoy talking to. I think some of the stuff some of his theories about the war in Iran and the Trump administration, the way they've been running things, that has challenged my views the most, because I see what the Trump administration is doing as completely insane, irresponsible, and off the wall, corrupt. And Tom has a different view on a lot of those things. And I disagree with him on most of what he's saying. But as I do so, while trying to keep an open mind, there are certain aspects that make me think and that make me reconsider certain angles. So Tom's probably the guest that has been most opposed to my own view when it comes to the current geopolitical world and the Trump administration. When it comes to more the investing side of things, like I said, I get challenged every week when I speak to people about a lot of things. Perhaps the few guests I've had on that actually are not so bullish on the commodities sector, don't necessarily believe we're entering a commodity super cycle, because like I said, we live in an echo chamber. So there's a few people that I've had on who maybe come from the more, a non-commodity side of the investing world, and who come on the show and talk about how, certain commodities are interesting, but as a whole, they don't really see the big picture. That challenges my beliefs and makes me rethink things. And people who are bearish on oil, actually, there's a lot of people I really respect who are bearish on oil. Edward Dowd, Gareth Soloway. There's kind of a list of people, Francis Hunt. I mean, there's a list of people who've come on my show and said they don't see any future in the oil market, and there's going to be a global recession, and oil's going to go to $30 to $50 a barrel. This was obviously pre war in Iran. Doomberg, my God, I love Doomberg, but I violently disagree with his views on energy and on oil. And this guy, who am I to disagree with these people, right? Doomberg does these, presentations. He's an expert on the energy sector. His team's an expert on the energy sector. I think they're dead wrong. And that's another thing that people have to keep in mind, is that at the end of the day, you have to have your own opinion. You can disagree with somebody who's an expert, and you might be right, but you have to have your own, you have to do your own analysis and your own research and come to your own conclusion. And because I speak to so many people and get so many different opinions, it allows me to kind of calibrate my own worldview in a way that takes pieces of each guest's knowledge that I find that I think makes sense, and kind of put my own thesis together. So that those are the biggest takeaways I've had. And yeah, so I guess concretely, Tom Luongo has challenged me the most on the geopolitical side, and Doomberg has challenged me the most on the energy side. And both of them, because I so violently disagree with both of them, I don't use that as a way to cut them off or say they're idiots. I go, well, maybe they have some information. Maybe I'm missing something here. And although I believe my view is still correct versus their view, there's some aspects of what they're saying that I need to consider, particularly when it comes to investing, right? So I think it's important to keep an open mind.
Yeah, it's like it might be a certain premise here or there, but like you follow their line of reasoning a lot of times and you go, that's sound. Like I disagree, but like why I disagree, but there's some, at least you can see how they get there, and it's very helpful for me to kind of see even opposing views. But you get a front row seat on just like some of the biggest, sharpest minds. Where do you sense people are not paying enough attention to, whether it's the guests that you speak to, or just people in general, or the media, like that maybe you think should be on the front of mind here?
Well, I would have said energy before the Iran war kicked off and oil spiked to over $100 a barrel, because before that was happening, energy was dead, oil was dead. People, it had been put in the dustbin, and at that point in time, I thought it was one of the greatest opportunities in the commodity sector that was beaten down, hated, and everybody thought was going away. That's changed at this point. I think people need to be pretty cautious now because of how high and how fast prices have moved, and because we're in a weird era of markets where the president can put something on Truth Social and literally move markets up or down. I think it's a very dangerous time to be allocating capital. So I'm mostly sitting on the sidelines observing from now and seeing how things shake out. But the other area would be uranium. And the uranium sector, I think, is the greatest potential asymmetric bet to the upside in the whole commodity sector right now. Now, it's extraordinarily volatile. It's been extremely volatile recently, double-digit percentages up and down in a lot of these equities within days. So it's a very difficult sector to invest in if you don't have conviction and really understand the thesis. But it's a simple supply-demand story. Not enough uranium is currently being mined to meet current reactor demands, let alone future reactor demands. We live in an era where the above-ground inventories have largely been drawn down. It was a long time post Fukushima where we had these above ground inventories. We had the megatons to megawatts program post Cold War, where Russia converted a lot of its nuclear warheads into nuclear fuel, and there was all of this abundance of uranium around. And now we're in a completely different era, and we're seeing all sorts of problems facing the uranium sector, from the biggest giant of them all, Kazatomprom, which traditionally produces a third of the world's uranium, now cutting their production guidance, facing issues with sulfuric acid shortages for their ISR mining operations. Cameco has reduced their production guidelines as well, spoken about potentially having to go to the spot market to buy pounds to fulfill long-term contracts. These are the two biggest giants in the room, essentially, when it comes to the publicly traded uranium companies, and they are facing issues. Everything from coups in Niger, which shut down GovX and which potentially threatens global atomic there, to, I think Paladin recently had issues in Canada. We're seeing all sorts of problems emerge with these, from the big producers to the developers who are trying to ramp up to production. Mining's a very tough business. There is just nowhere near the amount of uranium being produced today. I mean, think about it. In the United States, they use 20% nuclear energy, and basically they have zero uranium production. Okay, Energy Fuels is producing some, Ur-Energy is producing some tiny amount. Encore, I think, is producing, but if you, in terms of the amount needed, you can count it as zero. It's basically zero. So how does that make any sense? And now we're entering an era where we're trying to reduce, the West is trying to reduce their dependence on China when it comes to commodities, when it comes to supply chains. And so I just see it as a no-brainer that the uranium industry in the US, it's already started to wake up. I think that's going to continue. And so I think it's uranium. I think that should be on people's radars. I think most people should probably just buy the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust, which is just they literally buy physical uranium, store it somewhere, and you're purchasing essentially a certificate that represents physical uranium. So if you believe in the uranium thesis and you have looked into the supply demand fundamentals and you see them as bullish, then I think the best way is to just simply buy the commodity itself or buy URNM, which is an ETF that holds like a basket of miners heavily weighted to Cameco, Kazatomprom. It's got Sprott Physical Uranium Trust in there. And I think those are probably the best ways to play the space for the vast majority of people. Those who want to get into the weeds, the issue is a lot of these companies are not worth the on your screen. I think the sweet spot, if you're looking for the greatest upside potential without taking on too much risk, is developers that have a clear path to production. But keeping in mind that these economic assessments, I think this goes for the mining space in general, don't necessarily equal the reality of what the situation will be once it comes time to produce. But there's several projects with extremely attractive economics, Denison Mines, NexGen Energy. I think these will probably be the two next producers in the Athabasca Basin. But you got to realize it takes much longer than you think it'll take to get to production. And the economics that you see in these PEAs, these feasibility studies, et cetera, you have to take them with a big grain of salt.
Jesse, if you can tell us a little bit more about commodity culture, maybe a little bit about, what you most like about it and just kind of how where people can find your work and find you.
Commodity culture on YouTube. I sit down every week with industry experts when it comes to the commodity sector. I talk about geopolitics a lot and how the geopolitical landscape influences the commodities market. I talk a lot about gold and silver, and I just love being able to sit down with so many different people with different points of view, and I learn so much from it. I think the audience learns a lot from it as well. And you can find that, as I said, on YouTube at Commodity Culture. I'm on X at Jesse B. Day. And that's kind of my pitch.
Well, Jesse, I appreciate your insights today. I'm just Steve Yang here, learning alongside you from people smarter than me, like Jesse Day here. For everyone listening, stay smart, stay curious, stay disciplined. Jesse, thank you for your time. I appreciate your thoughts.
Happy to, Steve. Thank you so much for having me on.